final investigator I met with was Dr. Tony Ribas, and to begin, he commented on combination immunotherapy.
So blocking CTLA-4 and PD-1 releases these two major breaks, and that has been brought into the clinic with this combination of nivolumab and ipilimumab. The phase one testing was off the charts for response rates. I think it was 55% or 50% response rates in unselected patients with metastatic melanoma. So this has quickly been taken into a randomized trial, which was a three-arm trial: nivolumab single agent, ipilimumab single agent, or the combination. And it's very clear that the combination is better than either single agent. The response rate of the combination was 55%. Single agent nivolumab was very respectable at 40%, and ipilimumab alone was 19%. It's been one of the highest response rates we've seen with single agent ipilimumab. So it all tells us that we're making a lot of progress in a short period of time. But the drawback is the toxicities. If nivolumab alone has toxicities in a range of 10 to 15% grade 3 to 4 toxicities, when you add ipilimumab, you end up with 50% or higher grade 3 to 4 toxicities, and a great majority of patients being unable to receive the combined therapy for the intended period of time, and a significant number of patients requiring to receive corticosteroids to dampen the immune response that has been unleashed. So then we start thinking, well, if the combination gives 55% response rate and single agent nivolumab gives 40% response rate, then there's at least two-thirds of the patients that benefit from the combination that would have benefited just from single agent. So that's where it comes back to this idea that in the future, we're probably going to be personalizing therapy. We're going to be looking in the tumor, looking at the interaction between the T-cells and the tumor, how are those T-cells turned off, and then give the right immunotherapy to unleash those T-cells.
So the study did look at PD-L1 assays with relationship to results, and it kind of looked like the combination was more, you saw a greater difference, I think, if the PD-L1 was not there. Do you think that was significant?
Yes. The data from that study brings the mechanism of action. Nivolumab will work if there's T-cells in the tumor that trigger PD-L1. So it's logical that nivolumab will preferentially work on PD-L1 positive tumors. Ipilimumab does not work in the tumor, works in the lymph node. It releases T-cells in the lymph node. Those T-cells expand, circulate, and infiltrate the tumors. Well, if you do a biopsy before you give ipilimumab, in the tumor there's not going to be that many lymphocytes if they were not there before. So you can have tumors without lymphocytes with low PD-L1 that can now respond because you gave ipilimumab and at the same time release PD-1. And that study tells us that the group that benefited clearly from the combination were the ones that were PD-L1 negative at baseline, because those patients are unlikely to respond to nivolumab single agent and require bringing T-cells into the tumor that ipilimumab can do.
You mentioned the difference in response rate. What about the depth of response and the duration of response with the combination versus single agent?
There's been this concept that the combination therapy can give faster responses. And I think that's pretty clear from the spider plots that are presented with these studies. If we release PD-1 alone in a patient who has very few T cells in the tumor, it will take a period of time until those T cells expand enough to really fight the tumor. Sometimes it goes through a period of what we call pseudoprogression. I think it's most of the cases is true progression while the immune system mounts and gives an objective response. But if you block CTLA-4 and PD-1, then the T cells are unleashed at two different levels and can give responses faster. It's still not clear is the durability of responses. So will the responses to ipilimumab that can last decades be recapitulated with responses to PD-1 or PD-L1 blockade or the combination of CTLA-4 and PD-1 blockade? And that we still don't know. We're starting to see hints that the higher response rate with PD-1 or PD-L1 blocking antibodies comes with the price of some patients, a minority but significant number of patients, having delayed resistance or true acquired resistance to these therapies. So it is possible that the combination will lead to more durable responses, but we'll have to see. Since with the combination, a significant number of patients have to receive corticosteroids that dampen an immune response, well, we'll have to see where the numbers settle.
I'm sure your first option for a patient presenting newly diagnosed metastatic melanoma is going to be a clinical trial. But outside a clinical trial, in a patient where you use immunotherapy, right now, I'm not even sure how easy or difficult it might be to access the combination outside a trial. You can like comment on that. But what would be your preferred treatment? In what situations right now would you want to use the combination? Are there situations where you would want to just use an anti-PD-1 agent?
When we were talking a couple of years ago, we were separating metastatic melanoma between BRAF mutant and BRAF wild type. Well, now I feel confident to talk with a patient about frontline therapy even before I have results of BRAF mutation, because BRAF inhibitors and BRAF plus MEK inhibitors, which are outstanding therapies for melanoma, tend to have a limited duration of response that's measured in months. And the immunotherapies that we're talking about, the checkpoint blockades, has a duration of response that's measured in years. So with a patient with a metastatic melanoma, I now immediately think about immunotherapy as the first option. In the majority of cases, not all, there's extreme cases where we would think differently. And out of the immunotherapies, the PD-1 blocking antibodies have demonstrated in two randomized trials to be superior to ipilimumab when used as single agent. So a pembrolizumab and nivolumab in randomized trials have been better than ipilimumab. So if I start a single agent PD-1 therapy, I will use pembrolizumab or nivolumab. They give more or less the same response rates. Pembrolizumab is given every 3 weeks, nivolumab every 2 weeks. That's the only practical difference that I can see. And then there's the potential of the combination. The combination of nivolumab and ipilimumab has been reported in a randomized trial and published in the New England Journal of Medicine, but not yet approved by the FDA. But some insurances are starting to approve it because they see that if you have a better upfront therapy, patients may do better long-term. We would expect that the FDA will be looking at the data and deciding on it, and I would expect that it's going to be a positive decision because it's a positive randomized trial. And then we'll have to decide who should get the combination of ipi-nivo or nivolumab or pembrolizumab alone. And that goes back to these ideas of allowing the tumor biopsy to guide us what to do.
I was going to ask you before about the different types of assays that are done for PD-L1 and whether they correlate, whether there's a preferred strategy to do it. And would you incorporate that in your decision right now outside a trial setting about whether to use a combination or not?
The assays that are focused on PD-L1 alone by immunohistochemistry only record one side of an equation that's a little bit more complicated. It requires the presence of PD-L1 and T cells. I think with a short period of time, the field will incorporate the second variable and then will tell us if there's T cells that are co-localizing with PD-L1, that's a patient can respond to single agent PD-1 or PD-L1 blocking antibodies. And if there's no T cells there, we need to bring them in. So we should do a combination that also releases PD-1 because otherwise the T cells will get into the tumor and then they'll be turned off once they get into the tumor. Right now, I don't think we should use PD-L1 as a decision maker. But I think the field will move towards generating the right data to be able to use PD-L1 plus T cells as a decision maker of which therapy to give to patients.
For practical purposes now, though, could you describe a patient where you might lean towards just using a single agent PD-1 antibody? And I'd wonder, for example, given the toxicity of the combination, maybe an older, frail patient?
The majority of these immune responses to the cancer are mediated by T cells that recognize something that's altered in the cancer. In melanoma, it tends to be damage from ultraviolet light that induces high mutational load, and that's carried on by the melanoma. In lung cancer and bladder cancer, cigarette smoking. And we're seeing that the tumors with the higher mutational load are the more likely to have already induced an immune response that then is being turned off by PD-1. So if I have a patient coming to my clinic who's a 65-year-old with a melanoma that started in the scalp and became metastatic, I'm very likely to give single-agent PD-1 therapy to that patient because I'm thinking, 65 years old, a scalp melanoma that has been it's in a sun-exposed area, it's very likely to have a high mutational load that should have allowed the T-cells to turn on and then infiltrate the tumor. There's no clinical data about this. There's no clinical trial data. I'm just talking about my personal experience. And if we just looked at patients with chronic skin sun damage or patients who have tumors with high mutational load, I'm pretty sure we're going to see there's a higher response rate to PD-1 alone, and we don't need the combination on those.
That's really interesting. Has it been looked at where the site of the primary was and whether it was sun exposed in response?
No, it has not, but it's probably something we should be doing. There's one subset of melanoma called desmoplastic melanoma, which is less than 1% of melanomas, of skin melanomas. It tends to appear in the chronic sun-exposed areas in the head and neck, and it tends to be a local problem with very few metastases, and those are patients that get big defigurating surgeries. I thought that desmoplastic melanoma was untreatable beyond surgery. I had never seen desmoplastic melanoma respond to anything. Some patients would have these big lesions in the head and neck that I'm pretty sure we would have poured any toxin into them and the tumor would have left and continued growing. But now we're seeing that if we release PD-1, those tumors disappear. And it's because desmoplastic melanoma has a higher mutational load. It's induced by, it's very related to chronic sun damaged skin. And one of the diagnostic features is that there's a reaction of T cells on the desmoplastic melanoma. It's all there. All what happened was is that we didn't know until now that those T cells were turned off by PD-L1. We just need to release it.
That's really fascinating. I was just sort of flashing on basal cell cancer of the skin. You know, we've talked a lot about hedgehog inhibitors. Have checkpoint inhibitors been looked at?
I hope there are clinical trials ongoing in basal cell and squamous cell carcinomas of the skin, two sun-induced cancers with high mutational load. I don't know about them, but I can tell you is that I've documented patients that came to me for metastatic melanoma, were treating the metastatic melanoma, and meanwhile, a basal cell or a squamous cell responded. Those are patients that have the same risk factor for these different skin cancers and tend to have higher frequency or basals and squamous. I have to say that not all of the squamous cells that I've seen have responded in those patients, but it's not a prospective trial.
Really interesting. You mentioned the issue of upfront use of immunotherapy and said, in general, that's the way you approach metastatic disease, even with patients with BRAF-positive tumors. What are the clinical situations where you would start with anti-BRAF therapy or the combination? What I hear a lot about is people with a lot of disease, a lot of disease-related symptomatology.
Yes, it's a tricky situation because BRAF and MEK inhibitors are outstanding therapies. There's 70 to 80% of the patients have objective responses. The median survival is over 2 years. It has shifted the survival curve of patients with metastatic melanoma and changed the natural course. There's some patients that have long-lasting responses, and we still don't know what the tail of the curve is. But in the great majority of patients who respond, the tumor will relapse. And it's the patients who have the more aggressive presentation of melanoma tend to have very spectacular responses, but then those responses are the shortest lived. As opposed to the patients who have the more indolent BRAF mutant melanoma, the ones that we tend to not give these therapies, those may derive benefits from years. I have a couple of patients that were on the phase one trial of bemurafenib, signal agent BRAF inhibitor that are going on for over 5 years. But then there's something about practical reality. The patients with less aggressive melanoma are more likely to respond to immunotherapy with little side effects, and that will lead to a durable response in the majority. And the patients with more aggressive presentations of melanoma may be less likely to respond to immunotherapy. Their tumor has overwhelmed the immune system, and the immune system is not being able to recognize it anymore. Many times when we have big bulk of tumor, we do biopsies, we barely see any T cell there. So it kind of sorts itself out, at least in melanoma. And then those patients, if they have a BRAF mutation, then I'll want to give them the benefit of BRAF plus MEK inhibitors.
What about the patient presenting with metastatic disease with extensive brain mets? Again, immunotherapy versus BRAF and a BRAF positive tumor. And what do we know about the responses that are seen in the brain to both of those modalities?
I think melanoma with brain metastasis continues to be one of our medical challenges and limitations. If there's very few metastases, 1, 2, 3, I tend to refer the patient for stereotactic therapy, and then I tend to start a PD-1 blocking antibody alone or in combination. But if the patient presents with multiple brain metastases that are either not treatable by stereotactic radiation or are progressing after it, then we're stuck with very limited options. There's anecdotal data that patients with brain metastases have responded to PD-1 blockade therapy. We still don't know with the combination of PD-1 plus ipilimumab what's the response rate, but there's clinical trials going on with that. Because of its higher response rate, you would assume that maybe there's going to be some more benefit. But we have to put numbers into this. We still don't know what's the frequency, and I cannot inform patients about that. We know that BRAF and BRAF plus MEK inhibitors can give responses in brain metastases that are previously untreated with radiation or after progressing on radiation therapy. But again, the duration of those responses tend to be limited. So we need more clinical trials, we need more data, and then we'll be able to better inform our patients.
You were talking before about the patterns of response that are seen with checkpoint inhibitors, and you were part of a paper at ASCO, Atypical Patterns of Response, where you actually tried to quantitate what was seen. I was interested when you said that pseudoprogression, in your view, was the tumor growing. I've heard people also say it's some kind of inflammatory response that's occurring around the tumor. What did you see in this study? I see you looked at earlier and then later pseudoprogression. What was the incidence, the typical pattern that you saw? And why do you think it is that this is the tumor growing as opposed to some kind of inflammatory process?
The evidence of pseudoprogression or an initial progression followed by response has been known for years, both with ipilimumab or CTLA-4 blocking antibodies, ipilimumab and tremelimumab, and now with PD-1 blocking antibodies. The presentation at ASCO was based on the large series of patients with metastatic melanoma treated with pembrolizumab, where the management of patients was by immune-related response criteria, which allowed that if a patient had an initial readout of progression, that patient was allowed to stay on study at the discretion of the investigators and the patient, even though there was a first progression, and then progression needed to be confirmed. And if progression was not confirmed, there was a stable disease or response later, then that patient would qualify as a response. So that's what we call a pseudo-progression. There's a readout in the scan of progression and then goes on to respond. The frequency of this is around 5%. It's not common. It's 1 in 20. And I think it's more or less the same with CTLA-4 blockade and PD-1 blockade. To know what the exact mechanism, we need to have biopsies of these tumors, because the two possibilities are that the tumor continues to progress and then it responds in a delayed manner, or that the tumor is actually responding, but there's an influx of immune cells that induce inflammation and make that tumor look bigger. I've seen some biopsies of patients with documented pseudoprogression, and I've done a series at UCLA. And in the majority of cases, we can see that there is growth of the tumor with an immune response that keeps mounting over time and then eventually infiltrates the tumor and wins. I've also seen biopsies where there's an inflammatory reaction and the amount of tumor is small and that inflammatory reaction looks like a bigger tumor. That tends to happen more in my experience in lymph nodes than in visceral metastases.
I know there's, you know, a limited to the statistical confidence here, but you all reported 4.6% of patients with early pseudoprogression, I guess, at first evaluation, then I think another 4.3% after. I mean, it is unusual, but it doesn't seem like it's rare. How do you separate out patients with, quote, pseudoprogression from the beginnings of real tumor progression?
At some point, we have to be physicians. There's an art of this, like many other areas of medicine, and there's a part of having seen enough of these cases to kind of get a sense of what may be the best course of action. If the patient is progressing, the scans show objective progression, and the patient is feeling worse, needs more narcotics, has more overall problems, I wouldn't be waiting for a pseudoprogression in that case. If the patient is feeling better, but one scan shows that a lesion is bigger, well, I tell, well, let's continue on. Let's see what can happen, because it's been documented that sometimes those can turn around. So it's a little bit of common sense and medical practice that needs to be brought into this. The best thing would be to biopsy the tumors. If the tumor is bigger and there's no immune cells, I wouldn't be waiting for a pseudoprogression.
What's the current role of ipilimumab alone right now? What do we know about its efficacy after patients have been treated with an anti-PD-1 agent?
With two frontline studies comparing pembrolizumab and ipilimumab and nivolumab and ipilimumab, nivolumab and ipilimumab in an indirect manner, but we know that the patients on the PD-1 blocking antibodies, pembrolizumab or nivolumab, have higher response rates than ipilimumab in single agent. So the new situation in the US is that the PD-1 blocking antibodies are the frontline therapy for metastatic melanoma, even though the FDA approval is lagging behind. But the majority of insurances and even Medicare have compendia listing for giving pembrolizumab or nivolumab frontline. So that leaves us with the patients who progress. Can they still respond to ipilimumab? And the answer is yes, there's evidence that they can respond, but we don't have a clinical trial that tells us what's the frequency of responses. We also don't have a clinical trial of adding ipilimumab to continued therapy with a progression of the PD-1 therapy, and I hope that kind of clinical trial is conducted, and then we can know what's the best course of action.
What about anti-PD-L1 antibodies? Which ones are out there? Obviously, one of them, we saw really interesting results in bladder cancer. What do we know about anti-PD-L1 antibodies in melanoma?
There's a series of PD-L1 antibodies that are being developed. The first one was reported at the same time as nivolumab, but it had a lower response rate and lower toxicity profile. And the conclusion was that maybe PD-1 was better than PD-L1. But I think in retrospect, it may be different characteristics of the particular antibodies as opposed to the approach. Because once we've seen other PD-L1 blocking antibodies, MPDL or the MEDI antibody, we can see that the response rate are in the ballpark of 30% in melanoma. And then when we look in other cancers, they seem to be comparable response rates. Each study is a little bit different. Obviously, there's always selection bias, but overall, they don't look that different. The problem with the development of PD-L1 blocking antibodies in melanoma is that PD-1, the two front-runner PD-1 antibodies, pembrolizumab and nivolumab, were so far ahead that there's no way you can chase them and do head-to-head comparisons. So I think those companies are working on combination studies that are based on their PD-L1 with other therapies. There's studies with BRAF and MEK inhibitors and a PD-L1 antibody. There's studies with tremelimumab, which is a CTLA-4 blocking antibody similar to ipilimumab, with a PD-L1 antibody. There's a series of studies that are the second generation combinatorial therapies that are being tested in melanoma.
We were talking about the toxicity of these therapies, particularly the combination, and there are a lot of things that you can describe, but I'm just sort of curious more at a global level. If you have a patient and you're about to start a combination on treatment on, what are you thinking that you're most concerned about? What are you going to say to the patient? Because you can't tell them about everything. What are the things you sort of red flag for them?
It's difficult. I start with making a schematic of how these therapies work, try to explain where ipilimumab works, where vaccines work, where PD-1 works, why does the tumor protect itself through this process. And then I talk about the BRAF and the effect of the BRAF inhibitors. And after talking about all of these and discussing the side effects, I tend to go back to if this patient has the possibility of responding to a PD-1 blocking antibody single agent, can have a durable response with minimal side effects. And I don't think we've lost anything by trying for a period of time on this therapy. If the combination of PD-1 plus CTLA-4 was freely available after approval of the FDA, then I'll have a longer discussion. And some patients may say, well, it's good to have a 15 to 20% higher frequency of responses, but the toxicities may be limiting, and some of them can be life-threatening. So it's a longer discussion.
Do you have any concerns about the combination being used by a general oncologist who has, you know, relatively limited experience?
I have a lot of respect for general oncologists. They've figured out how to use cisplatin, carboplatin. They do bone marrow transplants in the community. Some of them have even done a high-dose IL-2, which is much more toxic than this. If a therapy works, I see the community oncologists using them because they want the best for their patients. I'm pretty sure that with time, if the data supports that a subset of patients are better served by having a combination of a PD-1 and CTLA-4 blocking antibody, despite the higher toxicities, that they're going to be doing this. They're going to learn the same way that I have learned how to use it. Obviously, in a tertiary center, we have a lot more resources. We have specialists that are readily available. We can study deeper and we have more time to dedicate to individual patients. But the number of problems at the end is finite. You can learn the patterns of what's happening and then be able to have good educational programs that will convey that information to people who are using for the first time or who are seeing a particular toxicity for the first time.
What about the issue of the patient with a prior autoimmune disease? These people in general have been excluded from clinical trials. Can you talk a little bit about what we know? I mean, I don't know whether some patients maybe have been treated with these agents, and how problematic is it?
During the clinical trials, patients with autoimmune diseases were excluded from CTLA-4 and PD-1 blocking antibody therapies. But as they become standard of care and approved by the FDA, then we have to face this problem. Around 10% of the population has an autoimmune disease. So that's 10% of melanomas, and we cannot hide from them. On a patient with ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, I would probably not want to use ipilimumab, but I have used pembrolizumab, the PD-1 antibody, and actually the one patient where we used this said that the frequency of diarrhea had gone down instead of going up. I've heard patients with type 1 diabetes being treated with these agents, patients with rheumatoid arthritis, and we have to see the outcomes of that. There's an interest of several groups around the U.S. and internationally to contribute cases of patients that they have treated with autoimmune diseases with metastatic melanoma who have received a checkpoint blockade to be able to have kind of a report on what are the outcomes of that, because it's not been in clinical trials, it's not been in an organized manner, but the data may be there to be reported.
Subsequent to these interviews, on September 30th, 2015, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration granted accelerated approval to nivolumab in combination with ipilimumab for the treatment of patients with BRAF V600 wild-type unresectable or metastatic melanoma.